Hey everybody, how's it going? It's good to see you and talk to you again. I'm out of hibernation. It's been around 6 months since I last recorded, so if you've forgotten who I am, my name is Scott Newhouse. I'm a certified financial planner, and today I want to talk about how the financial media either persuades or manipulates you, depending on how you look at it, especially in an election year. Yes, it's 2024. We've got another presidential election coming up, and it will be between Biden and Trump once again. Now, every year that I've been voting, I have heard someone say this is quote-unquote the most important election of our lifetime. And given those stakes, and you know, I have to admit, when I hear people say that, it's kind of like the boy crying wolf in terms of this is the most important election, because we hear it every single election. But nevertheless, we're going to be hearing a lot of people really amped up on this election, and they are really going to want one side or the other. And that's especially going to be coming from financial writers and financial quote-unquote experts. And these experts are going to be trying to share information with you. And we all want to be educated. We all want to be knowledgeable about the issues at hand, especially over the next few months before we really get in to election season. But what I want to share with you today is that we can't always take these financial experts at face value. And the reason for that is because they are very skilled at sometimes sharing really factual information, things that are absolutely facts. It's not misinformation. It's not fake news. It's a real fact that they're sharing. But oftentimes, maybe even most of the time, these financial experts do not share the whole context of what's going on. They do not share both sides of a specific issue and all of the other things that you need to be thinking about when you look at that one specific issue. In other words, these are really smart people who are smart enough to cherry pick data and information and frame it in a certain way so that you arrive at their desired conclusion. But they leave out much needed context to allow you to make an informed, independent decision on your own. And so that's why I say the financial media is either persuading you, which is a good thing. We all have to persuade people in our lives throughout life at various times, or are they manipulating you? And that's obviously a terrible thing. And I think oftentimes they're manipulating you because they are withholding key information that you would need to make a well-informed decision in your own opinion. So let me go through some examples and make this a little bit more clear so you can see where I'm coming from, be a little bit more educated, and then we'll get out of here for today. The first is from Paul Krugman, talking about inflation. Paul Krugman has won a Nobel Prize in economics. He has a weekly, I think weekly, column in the New York Times. And let's go into what he has to say on Twitter, or X, whatever you want to call it, about inflation. I'm going to go through three examples, and then I'm going to talk more in depth about those three examples. So the first one is from Mr. Krugman: your regular reminder, if it were not for owner's equivalent rent, which is essentially what a property owner would have to pay in rent were they renting it out at that time. So if it were not for owner's equivalent rent, a price no one pays, that's accurate, nobody would be talking about inflation. And so for you on the podcast, he basically shows a chart of inflation that peaks at around 10% in mid-2022. And then in the chart that he shares, it drops to around 2.5 by the end of January 2024. And we're going to talk more in depth about these in a second, but I just want to share the tweets first. The second tweet, Mr. Krugman says, the war on inflation is over. We won at very little cost. And then what he shows is a chart from January 2022 until September of 2023 with the sixth month change of an annual inflation rate from that time period. And it starts at around 6% in January of 2022, and it drops all the way down to around 2% as of September 2023. And I should also note, very importantly, that it's the consumer price index, excluding consumer price index is the CPI, CPI excluding food, energy, shelter, and used cars. Again, I'll have more commentary on that in 1 second. And then the third thing that Mr. Krugman says about inflation is that, so if I were going to argue that consumers are not feeling disinflation because they're focused on groceries, not the overall CPI, I'd probably note that grocery inflation has declined even faster than overall inflation. And again, he's showing a similar chart to the first one where inflation peaks in the mid, in mid-2022, and this is just for groceries, this chart that we're looking at, and it peaks at around, oh, I don't know, like 13 to 14% in mid-2022. and then it drops all the way down to around 2% as of, that's probably like the October or December of 2023. So inflation for groceries is what the chart that we're looking at here, and it has come down quite a bit. So let's go on to my commentary on why I really don't think Mr. Krugman is being completely intellectually honest here with us. First of all, the first chart that he's showing shows us year-over-year inflation rates, and that's based on percentages. And so the current inflation rate in his chart shows around 2.5 to 3% inflation increases year-over-year, so from January 2024 from January 2023. But here's the problem that I have with that. That's not how people actually experience inflation. It's also not how people pay inflation. They don't pay for it as a percentage. They pay for it cumulatively over time. And when you look at the cumulative inflation that we've had from 2020, added on to 2021, added on to 2022, added on to 2023, added on to 2024, the cumulative inflation, it's pretty staggering over the last 4 years. And so here's some data points for you. The price of homes, the average home in the U.S. has risen 42% over that time period, that 4 years. At the same time, interest rates to buy those homes has risen from 3.1% to 6.8%, and I actually think it's a little bit higher than that. I pulled those numbers, I think maybe back in February or March, and I think it's probably touched 7% since then. Beyond that, buying a used car is going to cost you 35% more than it would 4 years ago, while buying a new car will quote-unquote only cost you 22% more. Groceries are going to cost you 25% more than they did 4 years ago on that cumulative level. Menu prices, i.e. at restaurants, are also up 25% over that four-year period. Also, a growing percentage of renters, people who typically have a lower net worth, lower incomes than homeowners, they're paying a higher portion of their earnings to rent. In fact, 22% of renters are paying more than 30% of their income to renting utilities. And get this, 26% of renters are paying in excess of 50% of their wages to rent and utilities. That makes it really, really difficult to do really anything else other than, buy some food on that other 50% and do some basic things. But that's really tight. And then finally, per Zillow, the income needed to afford a home is up 80% over the last 4 years, while income has risen over that same time period only 23%. Yet, going back to Mr. Krugman's tweet, he's basically saying no one would be talking about inflation if it were not for something called the owner's equivalent rent. Well, that's ridiculous. Look at all the numbers that we just went through. Look at the cumulative inflation that we've just experienced. It's completely absurd to say that inflation would be a non-issue if it wasn't for something called owner's equivalent rent. It's just an absurd point. The next chart, he shows how the rate of inflation growth over In the next chart, he shows the rate of inflation growth over time, but the chart that he shares specifically excludes, does not include, shelter, food, energy, and used cars. And so let me ask you, how long are you going to last without those four items? Do you know anyone in the U.S. who is getting by on a regular basis without those four items in their life? And as I just shared a few seconds ago, those items are up 25% to 42% over the last 4 years. And so if Mr. Krugman had shared those items included in his chart on inflation would show a much different inflation rate. And finally, to the last chart, Mr. Krugman is sharing how, in his words, grocery inflation has declined faster than overall inflation. That's absolutely true. But again, that doesn't mean that the price of groceries is lower than what it has been. It simply means that the price increases are less than the overall inflation rate. And as I told you just a few seconds ago, grocery prices are up 25% over that four-year time period. And so let me kind of explain why I think, and this is just my own opinion, why Mr. Krugman is doing what he's doing, and let me back up. What he is doing in my mind is he is downplaying the effects of inflation. He's basically saying that inflation is not as bad as all these people out there are complaining about, that it's really just a media-made story. It's people exaggerating it on social media and in the news, and that things are actually really good as it relates to inflation. And let me explain why I think he's doing that, which is, I think I know who Mr. Krugman is going to be voting for. He is not shy about it. I think he will be voting for Mr. Biden. And as far as I can tell, he's voted for every Democrat since 2008. And the reason that's important is because it creates an incentive for Mr. Krugman to present data in a certain way. We all know if there is an incumbent president who is trying to sell, an incumbent president who wants to win re-election, they're going to try and show what a great job they've done. They're going to try and show that, especially in the economy, which is pretty much always at or near the top of the list in voters' minds, that he's done a really good job, that the economy's in really good shape. So in my mind, Krugman is trying to sell the idea of a strong economy to voters in the hopes of his preferred candidate, Joe Biden, winning the election. And that's pretty much all that he's doing here. And so he's taking this factual data, he's not giving you full context about it, and then he's trying to show it in a way that's going to make you say, hey, actually, you know what? The economy is really good because of this inflation stuff. It's blown out of proportion. And I want to make something really clear here, because I know I have clients on different sides of the aisle. I know I have people listening to this podcast on different sides of the aisle. People who are right of center do the exact same thing, especially, you know, people who are planning to vote for Trump this fall. They do the exact same thing, but they do it in the opposite direction. And so they are going to be incentivized to show that things are really bad in the economy, that inflation's completely out of control, it's hurting people. And because of that, you need to vote for the candidate who is not in office, who's going to fix things. And that this year, that's going to be Donald Trump. And so people on both sides of the aisle absolutely play this game where they are very selective with the data that they have. They massage the facts in their favor while turning a blind eye to anything that does not conform to their biases or things that they think are going to hurt their chances of getting you to think the same way that they do. And that to me is manipulation, because you're not giving someone, as much context and as much factual information as you can. You're really trying to limit the scope of what you share with people so that you can manipulate them into thinking the same way that you do or that you want them to. Now let's move on to a second example that I have. And it's a little bit different because I'm not talking about a specific person, but an idea. And this idea that we hear in the U.S. is the United States, us as American citizens, we are paying the lowest, one of the lowest percentages of our taxes compared to our GDP as compared to any other country. And so the people saying that are basically saying they're trying to make the point that the United States should be paying more taxes as a percent of our GDP because we're paying much less than other developed countries. And they're trying to say that because they want to increase government services. And the first question I have is why do you focus on the percent of GDP as it relates to taxes, or the percent of taxes as it relates to GDP? And is there a better way to measure that so that we can figure out how much we're actually contributing compared to other countries? To be clear, when you look at these numbers, it's absolutely true that we pay a low percentage of taxes compared to our GDP when you look at other countries. But when you look at it a different way, the numbers tell a different story. So if you look at how much per citizen we contribute to the tax coffers in terms of tax revenue per person, the dollar amount that we pay per person is actually 12th out of all of the developed countries. Whereas if you look at it as a percentage of taxes to GDP, we're ranked 31st. And so how is that possible? It's possible because our economy is so large that even if we pay a lower percentage of our GDP than other countries, it still works out to be more money per citizen than many other developed countries contribute. So what metric is more important to you? Is it the percentage of GDP that we pay in taxes, or is it the dollar amount we pay per person that we contribute into the government? I'm going to leave that one to you. That's, take some time to think about that and make up your own mind on that. But the point I'm trying to make here is that when it comes to financial information and financial experts and politicians, they might pick a data point that conforms to how they, again, want you to think, but it's not the full context. And there's more than one way of looking at every single issue that we encounter, especially as it relates to financial things. Now, finally, let's move on to my last point, which is the much discussed unemployment rate. It has been trending lower in recent years, and that's obviously a good thing. But regardless of whether it's going up or down, that one number is not going to show you the full context of what's going on. For instance, if someone's looking for a job, they are not counted in the unemployment rate. Maybe their spouse is making enough money where they don't need to work, or they might be discouraged by the lack of progress in their job hunt and they give up actively looking. And we see that in something called the labor force participation rate. This measures the percentage of adults in the U.S., 18 to 24, who are actively looking for a job. So the unemployment rate could be lower because everyone has jobs, or it could be lower because many people have opted out of even looking for a job, and then they get excluded from the unemployment rate, and that obviously presents a much bleaker financial picture.
And for you listening on the podcast who don't see the chart that I've had up the last couple seconds, it's actually supporting exactly what I just said, which is during the Great Recession of 2008, 9, and 10, the unemployment rate obviously went up. It went up dramatically. And at the same time, the labor force participation rate went down. What does that signify? It means that people opted out of even looking for jobs because it was such a bad economy. They couldn't find anything. And so they did not even search for a job, which means they did not they were not counted in that unemployment rate. If they were counted, the unemployment rate would have been even higher than it already was.
On the other hand, there could be a scenario where the unemployment rate goes up and the labor force participation rate goes up, which could signify that more people are looking for jobs because they are excited about their prospects in a potentially hot economy. And if someone's actively looking for a job because they're excited about their prospects, but they have not found found a job yet, well, they're going to be counted in that unemployment rate, which is going to make that number higher, but it's actually going to be a good thing for the economy because they are optimistic and they will hopefully find something fairly soon. And then beyond that, and I know I'm getting into the weeds here, but when you look at these jobs reports, what kind of jobs are created? The media might report that 200,000 or 300,000 jobs were created, but were they full-time jobs or part-time jobs? Were they from people actively seeking a part-time job because that's what fits their life right now, because, you know, maybe they need to take care of their kids or a family member? Or were they looking for a part-time job because they could not find a full-time job with, you know, all the benefits and bells and whistles that come with those full-time jobs? And yes, the government actually tracks both of those numbers. Are you looking for a part-time job for economic reasons, or are you looking for it for non-economic reasons, i.e. you've got other obligations that you need to fulfill that don't relate to your jobs, that don't relate to, you know, the economy, but relate to your personal circumstances? Now, I actually do have one more point. I think I might have said that was the last one, but I've got one more, which is what kind of jobs were actually created? What's the average hourly wage and average hourly salary of those jobs? And was this a government job or was it a private sector job? Obviously, we want the average hourly wage and salary to go up over time, but in terms of private sector and government jobs, that's going to tell you where the job growth is coming from. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what kind of jobs are better? Are government jobs better or private sector jobs better? Now, we don't have the time to get into this question in this episode, but I'm going to share a link where Carly Fiorina, she's a businesswoman, I think she worked at Intel, or maybe Hewlett-Packard, I can't remember. And then she was also a former GOP presidential candidate. She actually debated this issue with none other than Paul Krugman, the economist that we started this show off with. And so we go through all these different topics, inflation, money spent on housing, groceries, tax rates, and all of these are obviously going to be discussed in an election year. And the main point that I want to share with you is that one data point is not enough for you to make up a firm conclusion. So you can't just state the GDP or the unemployment rate or the net new jobs and simply think that you have enough information on what's going on with the economy. Also, you need to be aware, especially in an election year, that both sides really want their party to win. Again, as I said before, we're going to have many people saying this is the most important election of your lifetime, which they say every single time we have a presidential election. And the people that really want their party to win, when they feel like it's really high stakes, they're going to manipulate the data and present it to you in a way that looks really attractive, but you've got to ask yourself, are they really giving me the full context? Are they giving me the full information that I need to make, you know, the most informed decision possible? And so my advice to you is, if you're reading a left of center newspaper, article, podcast, they're generally going to push economic news, in my mind, that is more that shows the economy in a more favorable light for Mr. Biden, because they want him to win, and they know if it's a good economy, more people are going to be more, you know, persuadable to vote for him. And if you're reading a right of center newspaper article, talk radio, what have you, they're going to show you economic data that presents things in a really pessimistic pessimistic manner, leading you to think things are bad, and therefore we need to elect someone new, like Donald Trump. And so at least that's how I see it in 2024, when the party switched and we have a Republican as the incumbent and Democrat challenging them. I think the roles are going to reverse there as well. If you want to be an informed citizen, and I know you all do, you've got to be really cautious and curious when your quote-unquote own side presents information that you want to hear, and you've got to be willing to seek out people who disagree with you and will share things in a new light that you may not have previously thought about. And then from there, you can make up your own informed decision. But what we do not want to happen is we don't want one person to share one thing with us and immediately agree with them, because then we're going to put ourselves really susceptible to being manipulated by people who are massaging the data and trying to present it in a certain way, as opposed to informing you about, you know, what's going on, and then letting you make the decision from there. So I hope this episode is helpful. I'll be having a new episode out soon, and I will talk to you then. Bye.